Welcome to this new episode of the Teachers of Europe podcast. This is a podcast to support teachers across Europe in addressing common classroom challenges and featuring educators that can inspire others to follow in their footsteps. The podcast has its home on the European School Education Platform, a European Union platform for schools funded by the Erasmus Plus program. My name is Benjamin Hertz, and I'm your host for this episode. And today we're discussing a topic that's really at the core of creating an equitable and inclusive education system, and that is special educational needs, or SEN in short. Now, we know that across Europe, there are many schools and teachers who are really striving to ensure that all their students, regardless of their abilities, challenges or needs, have access to a meaningful and valuable education experience. But we also know that achieving true inclusion is far from a simple endeavor and far from a reality in probably most schools across Europe. And achieving true inclusion is a journey that requires deep reflection, collaboration among many stakeholders, and really bold action to dismantle barriers, rethink traditional norms, and most importantly, I would say, to truly listen to the voices of the students we work with, the parents we work with, but also the voices of teachers. And that's why we're here for. We'd like to understand better how to achieve inclusive education and to make sure we support students with special educational needs in the best possible way. And I'm very happy to have two remarkable guests with us today here who bring, I'm sure, very unique perspectives to this conversation. Our first guest is Inge van der Putte, an expert in inclusive education and a researcher at Ghent University. Inge has worked extensively to support teachers, schools and families in building inclusive environments. And I'm sure her insights into the systemic challenges and opportunity in this area will be extremely interesting to listen to. So many thanks for joining us, Inge. Could you maybe say a quick few words about yourself and in particular, how you got interested and working on the topic of inclusive education and SEN?
Yes, thank you. I work at the University of Ghent, and there I'm involved in a research group, Disability Studies. And when I was a student, so 25 years ago, I went to Australia, and there I could see what inclusion means if you have a long tradition. So I was really inspired, and now I'm working on inclusive education. I'm also the national coordinator for inclusive education for the European Agency. So it's very nice to have a broad view and to connect it with all the projects I'm doing.
Excellent. Many thanks, Inge. And yeah, great to benefit from your long and rich experience in this area. Now, our second guest is Raffaella Puglio. She's a passionate and dedicated teacher who has firsthand experience of working with students in her day-to-day work. She's a teacher and special educational needs assistant at one of the European schools in Brussels, and I look forward to hearing from her on-the-ground perspective, the joys and the struggles of making inclusion a reality in the classroom. So many thanks for joining us, Raffaella. Very briefly, what's your story? How did you end up becoming a special educational needs assistant?
Well, thank you very much for this invitation, Ben. I was born and raised in Greece, in Thessaloniki, where I graduated from the University of Macedonia and I hold a major in education and training of people with disabilities. Since I was very, very young, when I was a primary student, I realized that my passion was teaching and my passion was helping my classmates who were struggling with learning disabilities and emotional disabilities. Actually, I had classmates with ADHD and Down syndrome all of my school years. And that were the early signs, okay, that was made for me. I really wanted to study that area. And I always wanted to be a special needs teacher. I had the opportunity to teach immigrants and refugees in Greek islands when I was relocated by the Greek Ministry of Education. And now I'm Brussels-based in the European School of Brussels.
Many thanks, Raffaella. Excellent to have you here with us today and look forward to hearing more from all of your experience in this area. And I'd like to pick up actually now on something that you just mentioned, because you said you have experience of working with students who come from immigrant background or refugee background. I'd like to understand a bit better what we actually mean when we talk about special educational needs, what it actually refers to, and also what teachers need to know about identifying such needs. Because SEN is such a broad term and it covers a huge diversity of needs. You've mentioned ADHD, you've mentioned Down syndrome, mentioned refugee children. So let's try to understand that a bit better. And I'd like to ask you, Inga, this question. When we talk about SEN, what do we actually mean? And what are some of the most common types of needs, special educational needs, that teachers will come across in schools?
Yeah, what we see is that maybe in the beginning or a couple of years ago, when we were talking about inclusive education, it was connected with children with a disability. But now we see that we look at it in a more broader perspective, and that we look at it, it has to do with the diversity that is in your classroom. What we see in all Europe is that we have more children who have a multiple language, and that we are looking how can we adapt our system. And I just will give a brief example. What we are seeing in Flanders is that we have now at the time more children with that are diagnosed with a speech disorder. But if we look in depth, we can see that it are much of the time it are children who have a multiple language. So we have to be very aware of what are the things that are playing in our society. And it's not that there are more deficits, but that we have challenges and that we have to think about our structure, our educational structure. How can we adapt it? How can we change it so that it will give an answer on the needs that are there?
Many thanks, Inga. So if I understand that correctly, it means that on the one hand, we still have in this area of special educational needs, children who have physical disabilities or other types of disabilities, but it also incorporates certain needs that come from maybe their social economic background or the fact that they have a different mother tongue at home. Would that be a correct understanding of yes?
Okay, yeah. Excellent. Thank you.
And Rafaela, can you maybe pick up on this from your experience? How do these needs present in the daily classroom settings? And maybe you can just pick two of the examples that Inga has referred to. What challenges do you see in the classroom for some of these students that Inga has mentioned?
Well, from my experience and understanding for more than 10 years, I can see that dyslexia and ADHD it present challenges in the classroom, both for the students who have those kind of special competencies, but also for the teachers and for their learning peers, their classmates. Dyslexia shows difficulties with reading, spelling, and decoding words, despite having a normal intelligence. The pupils are struggling to recognize familiar words quickly, which makes reading fluently difficult. They may frequently misread words or have trouble in understanding what they have just read, or they have spelling difficulties. Maybe they confuse letters. For example, they mix up a B with a D, or they can write the words phonetically but incorrectly, unfortunately. Students with dyslexia and ADHD, of course, may take longer to complete tasks, especially when they involve reading, writing, or spelling. Students with learning disabilities are showing low self-esteem and they have hard feelings about school. They are really facing the failure of school performance. And they can also have social challenges. If other students notice that they struggle, and they may unintentionally make the student feel different. So the teacher need to adapt materials and strategies to meet the needs of the students. They could provide audiobooks, allowing extra time and other assignments for using graphic organizers, for instance. Also, I really want to mention that when we have students with ADHD, this is very, very common in 2024 classrooms. We're dealing with ADHD every single day. So attention deficit hyperactivity disorder affects attention, impulse control, and sometimes hyperactivity can lead to behaviors that can disrupt both learning and the classroom dynamics. Also, they can speak out of turn, interrupt, or have difficulty in waiting for their turn. Also, they might act without thinking, which can lead to mistakes or even accidents in the classroom. Also, in younger students, let's say in the lower primary classes like P1 and P2, students show especially hyperactivity, and they can move all the time, and they're showing difficulty in staying seated for more than 5 minutes. This can interfere with both their learning and of their classmates again. So it's very challenging because the teachers need to focus on how they can make them stay focused and learn. Also, they need to manage the behavior because that has impact in both areas of students, the students with typical competencies, let's say, and the students with special competencies. And that's why the teachers need individualized support for all of the students.
Many thanks, Raphael. So thanks for focusing on these very two specific special educational needs, dyslexia and ADHD. And I think let's come back to that in regards to looking at very concrete strategies for teachers on how to deal with that. But some very concrete examples that you've mentioned there, and I'm sure that many of our listeners will be familiar with these. Let's understand a bit better, however, how a teacher can actually take that next step of being able to accurately identify such a need. Inge, if a teacher suspects that a child has some kind of special educational need, what are the common mechanisms and criteria that are used to accurately identify a special educational need?
First of all, I think it's very important that a teacher does a lot of observation. What do I already see in the classroom? And make it very concrete. If you are a kindergarten teacher, you can take up paintings, for example, and to look at those paintings and look at what can we see. It's a child who doesn't have a lot of figures on it, or it's a child that can talk a lot about painting. So bringing in the meeting very concrete material is a big step in to think about what are the needs. Another thing, what a teacher also can do is to have interactions with different teachers. For example, I have to think about a teacher that has a lot of challenges with a child with behavioral disorder. It was disrupting the classroom, a lot of discussion in the classroom. But when she was talking with the physical physical educator, she said, oh, I don't experience that child in that way, because when we are having a sport, for example, we are doing football, it's a child who has very lot of leadership. I also think it's important that the teacher already goes in interaction with the team that is there, and that you already are looking at, for example, what is working in our interaction with the child, what strategies are working, that we also have the positive aspects in our view, and that we have already have discussion with parents, because parents are the persons who already are struggling or have a whole trajectory with their child. And then to have all those information, then we have to think about in terms of what are the needs that are here in the classroom, and not focus on the label. A step then is to go a discussion with different disciplines. Maybe there is a special needs coordinator in the school or a psychologist. So you have a whole team, and that you can have a collaboration with other people to get again a broader perspective, and that you can think about what are the plans, what are the actions we can set up and that we can implement in our classroom.
Can I follow up on something you said, Inge? You said not to focus on the label. Do you think that sometimes it's potentially less helpful to actually identify these labels for these needs and these children, rather than to take a more holistic, comprehensive approach?
Yeah, I think so, because we also know that from research that a label gives a false idea that we know what we have to do in a classroom. Sometimes it can help to understand. I don't say we don't need it, but it's important that we also have a focus on what is the need of this child and what is the need of this teacher. Because it's not that you have dyslexia that I already know what I already have to do. Maybe it is something that we have challenges in the instruction, then we need to take into account that we have to need strategies in that area. But maybe it's more like Rafaela was telling, that it's in the self-esteem of the child, and then we need to focus on strategies that will support that.
Many thanks. Rafaela, does that resonate with you? What's your experience from your work as special educational needs assistant?
It's very important to create the inclusive environment and to take into account the needs of the student and also the needs of the teacher and what needs to follow. Because I know that the curriculum is very demanding and it's very challenging for the teachers sometimes to apply tailor-made strategies and in parallel focusing on the maths curriculum and the literacy curriculum and apply tailor-made educational programs for dyslexic group of pupils or with pupils with ADHD or with other disorders that might appear in the classroom. And I really I'm totally aligned as well with what she mentioned about the collaboration with the families. It's very, very, very crucial for the holistic approach that we need to take into account for supporting pupils with special needs. As well as I really agree with the labeling. Labeling is not working effectively. From my experience, I must say that pupils dress up that label. They might say, "Oh, Rafaela, I cannot work on that math exercise because, you know, I have ADHD. So I know that I can't complete that task, Rafaela. So don't push me." So yeah, labeling is not working from my point of view as well. But it's very important to raise the awareness, to provide information that not all the people, we should not take for granted that when we have a diagnosis, a teacher or the community that the child is in are aware about that. So the diagnosis helps out in understanding.
I think there are two really important points in what you said. One is, first of all, to also understand the needs of the teachers and all the constraints that they operate in. I think we tend to put a lot of pressure on teachers to deal with many different issues, and we need to recognize that there is only limited bandwidth that a teacher has. And the other thing is the point you mentioned about the students' awareness also of how to use these labels. I just know anecdotally from talking to teachers that is apparently quite a common issue for them, that the students sometimes misuse this label in a way that is actually not productive to facilitating their learning. So interesting to hear that also from your side, Rafaela. Many thanks. Maybe a final question about this. Considering the diversity of needs that are encapsulated in this term SEN, and really picking up from what Inga said at the beginning of this part, that it covers both physical and other types of disabilities, but also certain needs that originate from socioeconomic backgrounds or language-related backgrounds. Does it actually make sense to talk about SEN in general, or is it more helpful for us to address specific needs individually? Inga, let's start with you, and then we can go to you, Rafaela.
You need a general approach, but you also need that individual approach. Why do you need a general approach? Schooling is a groups process. You know, the pedagogy of a school is about living in a group, learning in a group, but it's also about relationships, having friends, having the possibility to go in interaction with each other. On the other hand, we have to be careful to have a very individual approach, because we know from research, if there is a lot of labeling, like Rafaela was telling, if I have a classroom and I say I have 10 children with ADHD, 2 with autism, learning disabilities, that we see is that the tolerance of teachers is lower, because because of the big diversity that is mentioned. On the other end, we also need an individual approach to think about what are the individual needs and what are the reasonable accommodation that this child has to have. For example, as a child needs to have a computer device, then it's important that you can have that reasonable accommodation. We still have in Flanders also sometimes the discussion about it. Then they say, yeah, but it's not equal for the other children. They don't have a calculator or they don't have that computer device. And then we need to think about, yes, but here is a different starting point. Here are extra special needs. We need to be very careful. We need them both a general approach, but we also have to have that individual approach to think about reasonable accommodations.
Great. Thanks, Inge. Rafaela, anything to add here?
Oh, the answer depends on the context in which you're discussing SAN and the specific goals you're aiming to achieve. While grouping students under the umbrella of SAN helps to acknowledge that certain accommodation or teaching methods might benefit a wide range of students, overgeneralizing that can lead, if I may say, to ineffective practices. For example, assuming that all students with ADHD need the same accommodation, like extra time on tests, or that all students with learning disabilities will benefit from the same type of intervention is likely to miss the mark. Even within a specific category like ADHD, students may present differently. One student may struggle more with inattention, while other may struggle with hyperactivity. In everyday practice, addressing specific needs individually is more helpful and effective than discussing SAN as a general category when it comes to supporting them, when it comes to supporting students with special competencies. SAN is an umbrella that has a wide variety of conditions, and each of those conditions has different educational, behavioral, and emotional needs. So a one-size-fits-all approach won't meet the unique requirements of each student, which is why individualized strategies are so crucial. However, of course, talking about SAN in general can be very, very useful in terms of, as I said before, raising awareness, advocating for resources and political and systemic practices and actions, and promoting inclusivity. Both approaches, as Inga already mentioned as well, are very important. But from my point of view, when it comes to classroom instruction and student support, individualization is key to ensuring that each student receives the support they need to succeed.
Great. That sets us up very nicely, I think, to some further questions I want us to address in regards to quite concrete practical strategies that teachers can use. And let's start out by looking at sort of inclusive classrooms more generally. Inge, what do we mean by that when we say, okay, we want to create an inclusive classroom?
There are a lot of definitions. What I think is important is that we are talking about it's creating an environment where you are working with the diversity that is in your classroom. Another thing that's important is that we think about it has to be about children who are going to the neighborhood school, because inclusion is much more than an inclusive school. It's about creating an inclusive environment, society. So it's about belonging in that society also. What we see is that inclusion sometimes is narrowed down to a placement. It's about children with special needs or with that big diversity in the classroom. But actually, we can see it's about four values, and four values that are very important that we have attention to that. First of all, it's about the value of belonging, making sure that all children belongs to that classroom, to that school. The second value is that we create an environment where that children can show their mastery, their talents. The third value is about generosity. It's about every child can have a value to your classroom. We have an appreciated way to look at diversity. And a fourth supporting is about. We will support children so they can have an independence, but also the value of interdependency. And there we value the way that we are interacting, that we support each other, that we are interconnected with each other. I don't give you a very sec or clear definition, but I think it's important that we can think about it has to do with the way that we are creating that environment, and that's much more about values.
Great, thank you, Inge. I mean, those values that you mention, and I think sort of fairly broad principles that are part of inclusive education, inclusive classrooms, or inclusive environments, as you called it. I wonder, what are some very concrete things, how to turn that into the reality in the classroom? So question to you, Rafaela, can you identify some, from your experience, effective and ideally low preparation strategies that teachers can implement to make their classroom reflect more of this idea that Inge has just been talking about?
Yes, of course. Let's start with flexible seating and classroom layouts. You can choose seating arrangements that work best for them, like standing desk or cushion floors or worked at tables or desks when they feel comfortable. Let's say, for example, students with ADHD might benefit from sitting at a standing desk to release anxiety energy, while others with other sensory sensitivities might prefer quiet corners of the room. Or you can have fidget-friendly chairs, beanbags, or bouncing balls, for instance. Also, they can use visuals, like word walls, visual checklists, charts, timetables, diagrams, or color-coded materials. For the classes of the upper primary, they could have mind maps or flowcharts, and they can write and they can have them on the screen, so the whole classroom could have access on that kind of information. But for the students with special competencies, it's helpful for them to organize their thoughts. Also, they can give brain breaks and movement breaks during the lessons to allow students move around, stretch, engage in sensory activities. Sometimes they can use music as well. Also, they can use ThinkPairShare to encourage collaboration. So first, the students need to think about the question or problem, and then they can discuss their thoughts with a partner. That's very helpful, especially for the students who don't feel very comfortable and they struggle with attention and they don't have the chance to speak in public. They will have the chance to engage without the pressure of speaking in front of the entire class immediately. Also, they can simplify instructions and break each task into smaller steps. For problem solving, for instance, the teacher can write down the steps, like first steps, underline the star words, second steps, circle the numbers, third steps, highlight with your marker the question. Then four step follow on the operation and so on. And they can use as well peer support and buddy stamps. That's very, very important, again, for building friendships and social and emotional stability for the students who may suffer from learning disabilities.
Lots to work with there, Rafaela. Thanks for sharing those very concrete ideas. You used a term which I thought was really interesting, special competencies. And I really like that, because I think if we can frame these special needs as actual like strength of the students, if I just think about, autism or ADHD, of course, there are significant challenges for the students, but they often also have significant strengths in certain tasks or certain areas. And the same goes for students with who come from a different language background. We need to see some of the characteristics of these students as real strengths. And I wonder, Inge, is there any research that points us in a direction how we can do that as teachers?
I think the rich range of strategies or interventions that Rafaela is telling about, that is so important. But I just want to refer to research from Finkelstein. Finkelstein did research about what is important for a teacher to create an inclusive environment. And actually, he said, we need to take into account that there are five items need to work like a kind of lens camera that a teacher is looking through when she sees her classroom. And the five items are not that special, but it's first of all, she has to look at the organization of the classroom. How is it accessible for the children? For example, some children, like Rafaela said, need a headphone or something like that. So it becomes an accessible environment. The second item is to think about, how do I give my instruction? Is it on a differentiated way? Is it how can we make sure that that also is accessible? A third item is about to think about how your classroom environment has a positive atmosphere in terms of inclusion and exclusion. How can we make sure that the children belong to this group? A fourth item is about how do you follow the learning process of your children? If you are working in a very differentiated way, you have to think about that. But you also have to think about differentiated evaluation, for example. And the last item is about working together in a classroom, because if we have to rethink about how do we create that classroom environment that is accessible for all the children here, we don't do that alone. We need other people, like a classroom assistant, a teacher assistant, a special needs coordinator, a parent, a child, that can work together to think about how can we reframe this, how can we rethink our usual way that we are doing the things, and that we can do with little adjustment, make it accessible for more children.
So many different things, I think, there for us to think about, for our listeners to think about, and also to implement and try in the classroom. So I'm really sure that this is going to be extremely useful to the teachers who are listening to this podcast. And I'd like to continue, in a way, talking about these quite practical strategies, but narrowing down a bit more on, let's take just two specific special educational needs, which Rafaela mentioned at the beginning. And I think, well, as part of what you've talked about, you've already pointed to some specific strategies. But if we talk about dyslexia first, Rafaela, you've identified that already as a learning difficulty that affects the ability to read, write, and spell. And that can make the decoding of words and understanding written text, but also writing text itself, more challenging. What would be, Rafaela, your first advice to a teacher who is working with students who are dyslexic? What would be your main advice, as in a concrete strategy that they should try out?
Well, supporting students with dyslexia requires a tailor-made approach that helps them overcome their challenges related to reading, writing, and spelling, while building their confidence, while building their positive attitude in the classroom. I must say, from my experience so far, that they can use multisensory approaches. Like, multisensory teaching involves visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and tactile, I mean, when you touch things, methods to reinforce learning. Some examples: when you have students, you can make them trace letters in sounds, especially in lower primary classes, on texture surface while saying the sounds out loud. Also, you can do the oral spelling. Ask students to write words in the air with their fingers while saying its letter sound. Also, use letter tiles or magnetic letters to form words, saying the sounds as they build them. You can use different colors for different sounds, parts of speech or syllables, to help them with decoding the word, because that is very, very challenging for them. Of course, you should provide extra time and breaks. You should give them more time for assignments. Providing extra time helps them reduce the stress levels and gives them the opportunity to process the information with more detail. Of course, we have to mention the existence of visuals, graphic organizers, and visual aids. Use mind maps, concept maps, Venn diagrams to help them organize information. Provide visual schedules step by step for tasks and assignments. Also use color coding between parts of speech, type of information, or break up long paragraphs, especially in literacy or history lessons, into digestible chunks so they can understand the information. Also, dyslexic students often have difficulty with phonemic awareness. This is very common, which is essential for decoding. You should use structured literacy programs, or you should focus on direct explicit teaching of phonics, like vowel teams, silent letters, word families. And of course, I really want to mention that in the classroom, we should take consideration that we should limit the visual distractions. The calmer an environment is in terms of picture changes, the more helpful is for the students with dyslexia.
Is there anything that you would add to what Rafaela has just outlined, what research might identify as particularly effective?
Those tips and advice, you have to look at how do you tailor them, how do you adapt them to what does it mean for this child in this context. First of all, I just want to mention a research that is done for children with dyslexia is that we give a reasonable adaptation, for example, is giving more time to a test or an examination. But that we see of research that it's not enough. It's not just giving more time. It's also giving more time and teach them strategies, how they have to learn, how they have to work with an examination, for example, just scan the questions, then you go to the questions you already know, and so on. And so also the learning strategies, working with mind maps and all those things. So a lot of research is very critical about also the interventions that if we go to a school, sometimes they have a checklist. If you have dyslexia, you can have this. Another thing is what Rafaela was also telling is about it's much wider than only the reading or the writing. It's also about the self-esteem. It's also about the organization. And another thing is that there are a lot of things that are developing now in our environment, like ChatGPT, all the devices that are there that will be very helpful for children with dyslexia. But again, we have to think about what does it mean for this child? We know from research how important it is to tailor the reasonable accommodations.
Thanks for putting some of the very concrete ideas from Rafaela also into further context and confirming also the effectiveness of some of them. I'd like to continue this conversation with one more area, and that is, again, one that you've mentioned, Rafaela, or both of you have mentioned, and that's ADHD, which is, as Rafaela was saying, is increasingly common in many classrooms across Europe. What strategies, Rafaela, do you use when working with students with ADHD?
Well, as I said, ADHD is very common in everyday teaching life, and supporting students with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder involves creating a classroom environment and instructional approaches that help them manage their attention, impulsivity, and hyperactivity, while also maximizing their strengths and engagement during the learning process. Students with ADHD often struggle with organization and transitioning between tasks. Clear routines and structures help them know what to expect. And in this way, they reduce their anxiety and improving focus. Display in the classroom, whether it's possible, a visual schedule of daily activities in the classroom so students know what to expect. And that's helpful for all of them, actually. Use timers or signals to indicate when activities are changing. For example, you can use a bell or music for the transitions. stick to consistent routines for common activities. Like, let's say, what are we doing during the start of the day? You all line up and you bring me your agenda. I take the agenda and how you're going back home after we finish our day. Use short and clear instructions. Break down long tasks or assignments into smaller chunks or steps. For example, instead of saying, okay, let's start, write a report, you can say, step one, write the title of the report. Step two, write the introduction. And you can give them a word wall again with adjectives and verbs and conjunctions that they can use. That will be very, very helpful. Give instruction as well, one at a time, and check for understanding before moving on to the next step. That's very demanding, but those are some suggestions that each teacher could apply in his way or in her way. Also, use visual aids such as checklists to help students remember the steps, involve the tasks. Students with ADHD often benefit from physical activity to help regulate their attention. Providing movement options or flexible sitting gives them the chance to burn off excess energy in a very, very productive way. Again, give them brain breaks, movement breaks. It's very, very beneficial. You can use visual timers, of course, and charts and checklists. Again, color-coded, the same stands with dyslexia as well. And you can play a calming background music or white noise for focus if it helps reduce distractions and improves concentrations. Also, what's very, very important, give constantly positive feedback and reinforcement on the pupils. You need to praise them frequently, emphasizing on the efforts that they're doing and the progress that they're showing, not just the results. For example, you can say, great job, staying on the task for 5 minutes. That is amazing for you. I love how you wrote how you worked on that task. Be specific in your praise instead of just saying good job. Highlight exactly what the student did well. I noticed you remember to raise your hand before speaking. That is great for you. Well done. And of course, you need to have clear expectation and you need to use the stepping strategy.
Can you just clarify what you mean by stepping strategy?
You need to know what to expect. So step one, take out your pencil cases. Step two, take out your books. They can be, given the impulsivity that they have, they might find very, very challenging to organize their performance, their general performance in the classroom. So the stepping strategy is very crucial for them.
Yeah. Okay, lots to work with again here. Inge, anything that you would add here?
I think what Rafaela is telling is what we also see in research. There is a range of research, but what we can see is that the impact of a teacher is very high. Teacher can have really impact on the inclusion of children with ADHD and really by supporting children in regulating their behavior through being consequent, predictable, that were all the things that what Rafaela was telling in her strategies. So creating an environment that you know what is expected, that will help them to regulate their behavior, their impulses, but also to focus on problem solving. It has also a very high effect that they know when I have problems, how can I solution them? And have a big focus on positive behavior, positive feedback, because we know that the tolerance to children with ADHD is sometimes lower because of the disruption they give in a classroom to the flow of how a group is working together. And together with that, it's also important to support the social interactions in a classroom. As a teacher, you are a role model and you have to be a good observator how the social interactions are there. So have attention to the group's process, the way connections are there. Yeah.
Excellent. I would like to briefly talk to both of you about some of the kind of supporting mechanisms that teachers can benefit from. And both of you have already mentioned the importance of the relationship with the family. And I think, Inge, you also mentioned the importance of collaboration between teachers. Let's dive into that a little bit more. Inge, can you tell us a bit more about why collaboration between teachers, special education staff, and parents and families is really crucial for supporting students with special educational needs?
It's important to have other people, to have a reflection in dialogue, to know what am I doing, why do I certain things, what is the effect from my intervention. And there you need an extra pair of eyes. So reflection is very important, and you can do it on your own, but it's much more effective if you do it in collaboration with other people. Inclusion is about searching and to think how can we do little things that will make a difference. So having that out of the box idea, you can have that because you are collaborating with other people. And there are parents very important. And I will give an example. I was on a meeting and the teacher didn't feel that she made a difference to the child. She said, it was a teacher of history. And she said, I'm telling, and he doesn't give any attention. But then the parent said, but he came home and he was telling all about World War II, what was the subject of that class. So the teacher said, it's so great to hear that because I didn't see it. I couldn't see it on the body language of that child. So that also is very important to work together with parents to have that experience, but also to have their knowledge of who is my child, what works in past years, and so on.
Great. Rafaela, Inge has told us now a bit about why this is so important with some concrete examples of the impact this can have. But how to do this well, how to do this effectively? What strategies have you found in your work effective in improving communication and collaboration with families?
First of all, we are a team in the institution. I mean, we collaborate within the institution. The teacher, the special needs teacher, the psychologist, the occupational therapist, whether the institution offer that kind of support. We are a team and we try to build communication channels with the families, of course. I mean, by keeping notes and sending emails on a weekly or a monthly basis regarding the report. Also, we identify early the red flags. Like early identification is really helpful to build a clear and good communication with the families, because when you're reaching the point that their child needs to go and get assessed, that is very shocking for the family. So if you give them early identifications of from the things that you have observed in the classroom, it is very important to gain their trust and build a strong relationship that is going to affect the student. What's very important as well is that we need to respect the social, economical, and cultural background of each family. In the European school, we can have mixed families, for mixed culture families. Let's say, for instance, we have a student that comes from United Kingdom and Italy or Germany. So we need to respect that diversity and praise them, give them positive feedback, highlight the positive tasks and the positive things and performances that their child has shown. Highlight on the important and on the positiveness of the situation. That's very, very important for them.
Indeed, very important point. Okay, I'd like to close with a final question. And because we've talked a lot about what teachers can, should do, and well, we've also mentioned it that teachers are often overwhelmed by some of this, even though if they apply some of these strategies, ultimately, I think their work can get easier. But still, what type of support can we provide to teachers? What type of things should teachers be advocating for that would support them best? Advocating to their school leaders, advocating to their community managers or policymakers. What does research maybe tell us here about what kind of support structures that can be set up for teachers? Inge, this is a particular for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think a teacher should advocate to professionalization on the spot. Having professionalization in their environment, in their classroom, we know from research that it's not about professionalization of one meeting or one explanation you get or one podcast you get, but it's just about going into a process and that you can start from your own learning questions. What are the questions I have, the challenges in my classroom? And then come together with different teachers, experts, a mix of that, and they work with those learning questions. What can we think about interventions that are there and that a teacher can go to their classroom, can experiment with the actions, come back and have reflection in dialogue. And learning together is very important there. So I think that that is something that teacher could demand or could ask, because sometimes we think if we have smaller classes and so on, but actually it has to do with making sure that we have more structure of collaborations and also with working together with teacher assistants. It has to be on a collaborative way and not in a way that here is my problem, now the teacher assistant comes in and now it's the problem of or the challenge of the teacher assistant. No, we have to work together. So actually research always come to that conclusion that a structure of making sure that we can have collaboration, but that the teacher also get time to going in depth in that collaboration process is also necessary.
Excellent. I think that's a very nice sort of closing concept to keep in mind here. This importance of collaboration between all the different actors involved. And I think that's where also the European School Education Platform and e-twinning can really come in as a very powerful tool to facilitate this kind of exchange and collaboration between actors in schools, but also between schools. So a big thank you to both of you. I think we've covered a lot of ground, ranging from very concrete tips and tricks for teachers to consider when working with special educational needs students in general, but also specific. We've looked at two specific needs, dyslexia and ADHD. But we've also explored a bit the sort of the general understanding of special educational needs and how we need to talk about it, and how we need to think about it. I'm sure, as I've said before, that it has been extremely valuable to our listeners. And yes, I also want to take the opportunity to flag up all the different resources and professional development activities that are available to teachers on the European School Education Platform and e-twinning that are related to this topic. For example, we've recently had some courses and webinars launched on the topic of neurodiversity. We've had some courses around gifted and talented students, working with them. We've had courses related to working with families. So I think there is a ton of resources that can really benefit any teacher who wants to explore a bit more and wants to also engage with colleagues in a conversation about this topic. And make sure to keep also an eye out for the next year's professional development program that will be published reasonably soon, where there will also be courses and activities that are relevant for the topic that we discussed today. And then a final word to just say that we have another podcast episode coming up soon. So also keep an eye out for that. And it's a special episode. We will be celebrating in that episode the 20th anniversary of the eTwinning community, where my colleague Ruta will be talking to some old and some new eTwinners. And I'm sure we'll hear a lot of fascinating anecdotes from the past 20 years of this amazing community of teachers. A big thanks again to both our guests, Rafaela and Inga. Many thanks for listening and goodbye.